Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
We're going to start this week's show off with a nice $10 word, anthropomorphism.
Yes, that is a good $10 word. And the definition of that word is the assigning of human characteristics to non-human animals or inanimate objects.
It seems that that would be an important topic for us to talk about. After we've had a number of conversations with conservationists and people around the country about the big cats, the question of anthropomorphism has come up quite a few times.
Us humans are very good at anthropomorphizing everything.
It is just kind of part of our DNA. We want to try and understand our world by making it a part of us. But as you can tell, there's obviously some challenges that come with that anthropomorphism, especially as it relates to conservation.
And as you mentioned, humans, it's part of kind of our DNA. One of the things I was looking at showed that one of the earliest signs of anthropomorphism was a piece of ivory that's carved into a half-man, half-lion, and it was created about 32,000 years ago, and it's in a museum now in Germany. But it's one of the first symbols we have to show that even at that point, 32,000 years ago, we were anthropomorphizing. And I thought it was interesting that lion was the subject in that case.
It seems that we are often anthropomorphizing those animals that we either have a tenuous relationship with or represent something that we think is greater in nature. I'm reminded of the conversation that just concluded with Dr. Packer, where he mentioned how we as people have always looked for this Garden of Eden, hoping that there is something out there in nature that is better than what it is that we are, and oftentimes are ascribing that to them just for our own personal sanity.
Well, and I think we kind of see the animals as being closer to nature in some way, or in some cases even closer to God because of it. Even ancient deities were half man, half animal type things. You know, there's all these different signs we have of animals being part of our spirituality, like even spirit guides that are animals, and even the attribution of zodiac signs and such to humans, and most of those are animal-type signs.
An interesting thing in terms of kind of how our brains work, we are creatures that in many ways choose to find things that are of similarity. And there's always been this question that's been part of psychology and neuroscience, which is, you know, even though we like to anthropomorphize, why is it that we don't assign human qualities to everything? And of course, you know, some people would obviously disagree with that, you know, when they've talked about their stupid coffee maker or how their computer likes to play tricks on them.
But, well, we even anthropomorphize our machines, like cars. We see faces in the fronts of their grills with the headlights and the grills, and we call them she and give them names and all that kind of stuff.
And that's the key right there. If it appears to have traits similar to people, either through movements or some kind of physical features, we start to ascribe it human characteristics.
That's true. I guess we don't do that so much with things that don't have some kind of human-like behavior.
I passed a car the other day that had eyelashes and a big nose on the front, and it was hard-pressed not to see a face. And interestingly enough, even something as simple as headlights have become anthropomorphized over time, where instead of just being a big, round, bright light, LEDs are being used to create the appearance of eyebrows or cat eyes, and it's part of the daytime running lights that certainly gets your attention as you're driving down the road.
Absolutely.
The other reason why this is so important is because of its potential impact for conservation. So I want to play a little visual game with you here so you can mentally visualize something.
Okay, we'll work on that.
So if I were to ask you to think of something that is really endangered.
Okay.
If you think of something that's really endangered, what is the first instinct that kind of comes to mind about that?
Well, usually it's an animal. That's what comes to mind, even though, of course, there are endangered plant species as well and such. But animal comes to mind first. A fuzzy animal, in my case.
Okay. And what is it that you want to do with that endangered animal?
You want to protect it and hold it and keep it and call it George. I don't know.
Well, there you go. So the idea that this animal is endangered tends to elicit a response that makes you want to keep it. Now, I want you to think about an animal that is perhaps on the ugly side.
That's pretty easy to do.
Yeah, or even perhaps on the nasty side. Like, try and describe in your mind your favorite spider.
That's exactly what I was thinking, was a spider. How did you know?
Well, you'd be surprised that when people talk about this stuff, that's usually the first thing that comes to mind. And you don't see too many anthropomorphic spiders out there, with the notable exception of Spider-Man. And look what we had to do for him, is we had to keep him in with, you know, looking like a human.
That's true. He looks more human than spider.
I would bet you Spider-Man might be a little bit less popular if he had eight legs, was fuzzy, and had multiple eyes.
Probably wouldn't look too good. I think of the creature at the end of The Matrix that kind of looks like a big spider like that, but he was kind of a bad guy.
Yeah. Now, let's put the two of those things together. When you think about those elements like a spider or a really ugly creature, there is a bit of revulsion that's in play, something that makes you want to draw back or in some cases even react violently to destroy. But as soon as you ascribe that moniker of endangered in front of it, you've got a bit of a juxtaposition going on.
Right. You don't want to destroy that endangered spider, no matter how ugly it is.
And yet, the fact that it's a spider still, for some people, is more important than the fact that it's endangered.
That's true.
So now if you take the flip side of that and you think of something that's ridiculously cute and fuzzy, like, oh, let's say a tiger cub, for example.
Right.
Which tends to elicit the big, aw, isn't that cute? Isn't that wonderful? You just want to cuddle them forever and keep them forever. And now you say it's endangered and cute. What do you have then?
Well, then you have one of those species that makes everybody want to pay money to keep it and call it George and make it happy.
Exactly. And so this people will generally want to keep things around that they can anthropomorphize. And like we say, there's not too many anthropomorphic spiders out there. Though I imagine that if I asked you for a couple of names, Charlotte obviously comes to mind from Charlotte's Web. But if you were to ask, you know, well, how many different anthropomorphic tigers or big cats are there out there, then the list just goes on forever.
Actually, there's a whole list of them on Wikipedia of all these big cats that are in literature, film, and TV.
Exactly. So for those creatures that we feel a kinship to, even if it is a tenuous one, that degree of anthropomorphization is actually one of the methods that helps keep them amongst us.
Well, of course, look at pet owners and their pets. We constantly anthropomorphize our pets and give them attributes. But on the other hand, you know, there's good and bad with that. You do want to give them some kind of human characteristics to realize that they do have feelings and that they do need to be cared for and they're not just automatons. But on the other hand, I guess you could go too far with it and give them far more characteristics than they really have.
Right. And that's where the danger starts to come in. I think about the work that we do where we are trying to work with the cats, and they have a lot of characteristics which lead us to even call them personality. And there's a bit of bias even in the word using personality, ascribing personhood And that,
well, animality just doesn't sound so good. So
exactly. We ascribe personality to those elements. And that is, I would say, one of the most socially acceptable and perhaps socially subtle methods of anthropomorphizing that we actually use on a regular basis.
But, at that level, though, I don't know that I see a problem with showing the fact that animals do have some personality, because you can see differences between even the same kind of breed of dog or the same kind of breed of cat. You know, they do have different personalities from animal to animal.
I completely agree. And that's where we get into some very interesting gray territory, because what do you do and how do you interact with this personality? It starts to become very complex, which is why it's interesting that anthropomorphics and anthropomorphic animals are often ascribed to the realm of children.
Well, of course, many cartoons, almost all cartoons, are animals that are talking to us and such.
But yet, that's got to be incredibly complex. It's also got to be incredibly confusing in some regards. When you think about all of these anthropomorphic characters, it is requiring the child to come up with an awful lot of detail in order to really come to understand the differences between characters.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you were to imagine all of humanity, we are, for the most part, a relatively homogeneous species. Many people have identical features of eyes and nose and mouth and ears, and the shapes are all relatively the same, and with the exception of a couple of unfortunate incidents, usually someone will have two arms, two legs, and a torso.
Right.
So in order to determine the differences between people, you have to look beyond that silhouette. You have to look into how people are, and the differences depend in how those people interact. Now, if you were to instead take the animal kingdom, you could, from a silhouette, immediately identify the kind of creature that you're dealing with.
But, you mean like versus lion versus giraffe versus something like that?
Sure. You're yes. going to be able to tell the difference between a spider and a giraffe pretty quickly just from a silhouette.
Right.
And not just that, but you'll also be able to potentially tell a couple of things about them if you are following their natural behavior. But when you introduce the element of anthropomorphic characters, what you're doing is you're tossing all of that complexity of their physical differences and then running it through a filter of intellectual differences that are ascribed from the human.
Well, but also if you look at it from another perspective, for those of us that come out to, let's say, a sanctuary or a zoo and see animals of the same kind, we see lions together, we may not be able to tell them apart, but the people that work there certainly do, because they do learn them and learn their personalities. So there is some of that aspect of understanding differences between them beyond the silhouette.
If you're doing that in a zoo, sanctuary, wildlife setting, that's one thing. But if those same animals suddenly got up on two legs and started bursting into song or
talking and dancing,
dancing, having adventures, then now you've got a whole bunch more that you have to figure out with regards to it. So anthropomorphic animals are extremely complex, and that's why even in literature, when you have non-children literature with anthropomorphic animals, tends to be particularly challenging, because even our most basic assumptions have to go out the window.
We still have sort of a characteristic base that we apply to that animal that still ends up being part of that anthropomorphic representation.
Yes, a base that we don't have to deal with if we're talking about people.
Why would you say that?
Because with people, we are going to be of generally the same characteristics. But with anthropomorphic animals, they are going to have vastly different physical characteristics, which are going to have a vastly different means of impacting the way that they see their world. If I were talking to an anthropomorphic lion, for example, then it might be pertinent for us to have a deep conversation about the kinds of meat that we like. Of course, he may have some interesting perspectives on how best to prepare that meat. But I would probably not want to have that same conversation with an anthropomorphic cow. They might not find that too pleasant.
The preparation of meat? No, probably not. But there is still an aspect of we attribute a specific personality type to specific animals. And thus, when we make an anthropomorphic animal, that usually that base of personality is part of that animal. For example, when we say a lion, we do already think of majestic and leader and that kind of thing. You know, when you say something like, you know, a cow, maybe we think more of a follower or just, you know, one of the crowd, that kind of thing. And those kind of characteristics are still part of that creature, even though we anthropomorphize it.
Right. And even when we take it and we play it against its own trope, like, for example, the cowardly lion.
I was thinking that, actually. That's a perfect example of one that just totally goes backwards against it. That wouldn't have worked if it had been the cowardly cow.
Maybe not, but if you're looking at the natural history, then certainly then there's such a thing as a cowardly lion. Watching the interaction of prides, you'll immediately be able to see that there are some cubs that are always the ones who will be first to jump up on the log and look around, and some that are going to hang back and be a little bit more hesitant to get themselves out there.
And of course, that goes back to the fact that we said that there really are personalities for different animals. Just because they have the same genetic sequence in general to become a particular animal doesn't mean that they have the same personality as well.
And herein lies the fundamental challenge, that by ascribing the personalities to them, us as humans, we oftentimes ascribe personalities based upon whatever trope that our mother culture has whispered to us versus trying to establish the personalities from what would might be looked at as more of a biological mechanism, trying to actually see what they present with, as opposed to trying to assume that we know everything about them from just what their reputation holds.
Well, I think that kind of goes back to the difference between like a scientist and just your average person. I think your average person is going to tend to easily go and assign personalities just by the first few behaviors they happen to notice about an animal, and suddenly it's, you know, assigned a personality. Whereas a scientist is probably first trained to not try to anthropomorphize, to actually just observe and build that personality or character for that animal based on all observed behavior, as opposed to saying, oh, he looks like so-and-so and ascribing a personality to it.
It kind of makes you wonder, is that a bad thing? Does that somehow make it more difficult for us to fulfill the role of actually working with and conserving and making a positive impact on the lives of the creatures that we serve? Or is it a good thing because it creates a sense of normalcy as opposed to something foreign and incomprehensible?
Well, there's actually good and bad with that, I would think. In the case of a person just looking at an animal, being able to make that connection of giving it a personality, giving it human characteristics, allows the person to kind of communicate with that animal in their own way and feel a closeness to that animal that they wouldn't otherwise have. It's kind of a way for the human to connect with that animal, which also will hopefully give them the opportunity or the compassion to help protect the endangered species and such like that. On the other hand, if you look at it from a scientific perspective, they do kind of have to be more standoff and allow the animal to do what it's going to do on its own behavior and just observe so that they can try to determine a pattern or a personality and all those kinds of things for the animal without intervention, without being so involved as to attribute human characteristics to them prior to them demonstrating that kind of personality.
But doesn't that create an element of separation, because the ascribing of these personality traits to these non-human creatures makes a huge assumption. It makes an assumption that perhaps it doesn't matter whether or not you get it wrong. It makes an assumption that says that it's okay, even in the case of the scientist, it's okay to observe, to see, to make your judgments, but it doesn't require any true engagement.
Well, and from a scientific perspective, I believe you can go too far with that. If you have no feelings for the animal whatsoever, you could totally ignore the fact that these animals do have feelings and do have fear and those kind of things that need to be taken into account. You can't just treat them as creatures that have no feelings, that have no fear, and, you know, simply experiment on them without that thought.
And vice versa, trying to become one of the animals is somewhat of an abdication of recognizing that there are fundamental differences between them and us from a very physical, psychological, and in some cases perhaps even emotional way. Those differences not necessarily being better or worse, but present. And it's their presence creates the potential for problems for those people that do take it too far.
Especially in the kind of situation that you are in with the sanctuary and working around the animals as you do. If you take it too far where you're anthropomorphizing the animals, you may start ignoring the fact that they still are animals and there are still behaviors they're going to do that may be unpredictable to you. They're not going to be human behaviors. And you do always have to have that in the back of your mind, if nothing else, for the safety of yourself as well as for the safety of the animal.
It's a real interesting conservation challenge, where that line is. And it really has to do with how close, I think, people are to the actual work of the animals themselves. And perhaps I should explain, it may not be terribly important for someone to understand the psychology of a tiger. After all, unless you're having a very, very bad day, you really shouldn't have a tiger stroll through your office building. You shouldn't run into one at the grocery store. And you certainly shouldn't be standing behind one in line at the DMV. So from a survival standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have to know more about the animal than what allows you to survive and live your life. By the same token, if you do deal with them on a daily basis, if you are, let's say, one of those researchers who's wandering out in the jungles of Ranthambore or in the Serengeti watching lions, it would become extremely important that you have a familiarity with the animals on a one-on-one basis and a very deep one so that you can use those natural skills to predict what could potentially happen next. So I guess the challenge at that point is making sure that you get the right amount of anthropomorphization as a tool as opposed to just as a means of making things simpler.
Well, and obviously you can go too far. You know, what comes to mind, of course, is people's pets that they dress up constantly and put them in baby strollers and go a little bit too far maybe with the whole anthropomorphizing. And I don't know, maybe that's not a problem for the animal. I don't know. It's hard to say. But I guess it could be taken too far to where it does become an issue with the animal itself. Maybe it's not healthy for them.
Well, the issue of living dolls, I think, is going to be a challenge. And I would imagine that there are certainly some people who knows, maybe listening to the show that have their dogs that they put on sweaters and they, you know, they make special clothes for dogs now. And some of that has a purpose. Obviously, if you've got a dog that's working in a cold environment or needs that comfort that comes with the pressure, then it becomes very useful as something that is recognizing their emotional state versus just a fashion accessory.
Well, absolutely. I have a guide dog, which I often have to put sweaters on her when we're working and it's cold outside. She just gets cold. I mean, there's nothing I can do, but I have to keep her warm. So she wears sweaters.
Is that anthropomorphizing to say that she gets cold, or is that something real? Because obviously in a natural state, there wouldn't be a sweater.
Well, I say it's a real thing because I see her shaking, so I know she's cold. And obviously I'm putting her in an environment that might be colder than she's used to. Now, that doesn't happen too often here in Florida, but when I travel to other places and we go out at night and we're going somewhere and she's guiding me, it could be very cold for her. And for her to be walking with bare paws on the cold ground, yeah, she gets cold. She shakes. And I can see that. So I try to take care of it by covering her up.
This is a classic example where putting clothes on a dog could mean two separate things, depending on the context.
True. Maybe you really do need to cover them up and keep them warm. It's not always just for dress up.
So what do you think? Anthropomorphization. Good thing, bad thing, or just a thing?
Well, I think there is good in it. I think when taken to the extreme on either side of totally not anthropomorphizing or totally going overboard, it can be bad. But the medium range that I think most of us are in, I think is a good thing because it allows us to relate to the animals in a way that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
It's all about that connection, isn't it?
I think so. And even so, like when you see people talking to their pets like babies, it's that communication thing. We have that instinct to do that.
Right. We have a remarkable ability to communicate not just amongst each other, but also across species. And there's clearly some communication that goes beyond the two legs and the eyes and ears that we have. And it's important that we explore that. And anthropomorphization seems to be nature's way of giving us a chance to do that in a manner that is safe, as opposed to having to find out when we're already on the other side of the claws.
Well, besides, think of all the cool characters we wouldn't have if we didn't have anthropomorphization.
Exactly.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding.